From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
South of Market.
From Albany.
Hayes Valley.
Rockridge in Oakland.
I'm from the Civic Center. I live across the street.
Coming up, we'll see what the Bay Area looked like before there was a San Andreas Fault.
About 20 million years ago, we had these whales, desmostylids, an extinct order of marine mammals. They looked kind of like a hippo.
Then we discover what really happens to the Golden Gate Bridge in an earthquake.
The cable is the weakest link. So if anything is going to go first, it's going to be the main cables.
And we hear about a skyscraper that was secretly in danger of collapse.
They welded through the night and quit at daybreak, just as the building occupants returned to work.
How sturdy are our structures? Find out today on Cross Currents. Look around you, almost anywhere. There's a lot of development in the Bay Area, new stadiums, new roads, and in San Francisco, plans are underway to construct more than 50,000 new housing units. All of these projects require digging, and California environmental law requires that anyone doing major digging projects first call a fossil expert. So when work began near Fremont to rebuild the Calaveras Dam, paleontologist Jim Walker was called to the scene to hunt for fossils. He expected to find a few. Instead, he got 600. KALW's Holly J. McDeed met up with Walker to hear more about what the Bay Area may have looked like when these prehistoric animals were alive.
The other day, Jim Walker traveled back in time. No big deal. It's his job.
I get paid to go for hikes and look for fossils. It's kind of like a detective work. You can try and figure out what the world looked like way back when and what was going on.
Right now, he's trying to figure out what was going on way back when in a remote canyon in the Southeast Bay.
It's up in the hills behind Milpitas in Fremont. Actually, a very pretty spot. We have a view of Calaveras Reservoir, and then down below we have the dam and all the active construction.
The area where Walker does his digging is pastoral and dry. Today, it's inhabited mostly by construction workers operating dump trucks and playing with bulldozers. They're working on making the Calaveras Dam more safe in case of a future earthquake. But Walker says he can't help thinking about the distant past. Imagine it. The likes of Google and Apple wouldn't rule Silicon Valley. There'd be no Silicon Valley. Peace out, mankind. There'd just be a treacherous, unending jungle inhabited by the entire cast of Jurassic Park. You know, the whole dino gang. The loving and motherly duck-billed Mosasaurus. Stegosaurus. And of course, the legendary Tyrannosaurus Rex. Wait a second. Walker says the fossils he's finding are about 20 million years old. Dinosaurs were long gone by then. My bad. In reality, the world Walker is digging up was from the Miocene epoch, and it probably sounded like any old day at the beach. Walker says that's because most of the cities around the bay were underwater back then.
And the coast would have been near Mount Diablo.
If you were standing on that coast,
you might have seen whales off in the distance, or maybe dolphins swimming close to shore. We've also found the tooth of a seal, so you might have, if you were looking at the surf, you might have seen a seal head pop up in the breakers.
Dolphins, whales, and seals? How 2014?
About 20 million years ago, we had these whales, desmostylids.
Who? I don't think I know the guy.
Desmostylus is an extinct order of marine mammals. They looked kind of like a hippo, and they lived along the California coast.
And he's found fossils of other crazy big water animals.
We found at least one that would have belonged to a megalodon.
That's a big shark that scientists think was almost 60 feet long and that could easily crush the skull of a prehistoric whale as easily as a grape. Yikes.
Looked a lot like a great white, but it was quite a bit larger. Its space in the environment is now taken up by things like killer whales and stuff like that.
Sea beasts lived and sea beasts died. They sank to the bottom of the ocean. And over time, the landscape changed and the water went away too.
Probably the big event that would have changed the way the area looked is about 15 million years ago, the San Andreas Fault system would have started to propagate up this way.
The San Andreas Fault formed just about 20 million years ago. The central coast, scientists think, moved north thanks to the rumbling and shaking caused by earthquakes along the fault. Now, humble geologist, imagine the 1906 earthquake happening several times over, sometimes on smaller scales, for millions of years, giving California's landscape periodic makeovers over and over again.
So from that point on, we see things starting to, at least geologically, look a lot like they are today.
And the world keeps moving. And someday, someone might spend their day job looking for fossils of us. But for now, we're still here, trying to get our dams, our buildings, and our worlds retrofitted in an attempt to keep it that way. But just as a warning, if the Calaveras Dam failed during the time of an earthquake, experts say a 30-foot-high wall of water would rush towards Fremont and Interstate 880. But it wouldn't be the end of the world. The world would just look slightly different. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
That piece first aired in December 2014. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The rebuild should make the Calaveras Dam stronger in case of earthquakes. A report released earlier this year found that the big one is less about if and more about when. There's a 95% chance that Northern California will experience a quake of magnitude 6.7 or higher in the next 30 years, maybe along the San Andreas Fault. What will that be like? Hollywood has an idea.
People need to know that the shaking is not over. We'll get hit again, and it's going to be a bigger monster.
The new film San Andreas made $54.9 million in its U.S. debut. People like blockbuster disaster flicks. And San Francisco is often the subject because of its iconic Golden Gate Bridge. It's big, it's reddish-orange, and it's not fared so well in a lot of movies, according to KALW's sound engineer Seth Samuel.
I have seen a lot of movies. And knowing this, my editor Ben Trefney took me aside one day and said,
"Hey, Seth."
"Yes, Ben?"
"Hey, how about you make a piece that compiles a bunch of movies in which the Golden Gate Bridge gets hammered?"
And I said, "Okay, so here goes." Disasters often befall the Golden Gate Bridge.
It's an earthquake.
That puts the epicenter of the 7.1 earthquake right in the heart of the San Francisco Bay.
Sometimes it's an earthquake. Sometimes the Earth's core overheats and the bridge melts.
The whole West Coast is out.
Operations to all Navy personnel on the Golden Gate Bridge. You can do nothing more where you are. You're to abandon your post at once and not sacrifice your lives needlessly. These are Captain...
A gigantic octopus mounts it. And that's an ape roaring on the bridge. He sounds pissed.
It's a horrific situation here.
It struck.
Where?
Golden Gate Bridge.
We have to get off the bridge before...
One time, a giant woman cruised around on the bridge, using cars as roller skates.
I mean, it must be 300 feet tall.
Strike her! There's civilians on the bridge! Hold your fire!
Oh, and here comes Godzilla, and here's what he sounds like. Let's hear that again, because it is an awesome sound.
Get traffic off the Golden Gate Bridge. Red alert for Operation Speedy. Get traffic off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Cars are tumbling off the bridge.
Pull up! Pull up! Your hands on the bridge!
Ah! I can't pull up!
Luckily, the Incredible Hulk jumped onto the roof of his plane, knocking it off its collision course. And then, in 2006, an elderly man used his mutant powers to tear the bridge off its foundations and redirected it to Alcatraz.
Charles always wanted to build bridges.
Ah! think that requires the biggest suspension of disbelief.
Where do you think you're going?
Out on the bridge.
No, you're not. You want to get killed?
On the Golden Gate Bridge, I'm Seth Samuel for Cross Currents.
Seth Samuel is fine. You can find more information on Golden Gate Bridge disaster movies at our website, klw.org. Click Cross Currents. Film history, the Golden Gate Bridge has been leveled by earthquakes, ripped apart by apes, melted, and even bitten in half by a mega shark. But how would the iconic span fare in more realistic disaster scenarios? KLW's Isabel Angel wanted to know, so she put together this story.
We're going to take a close look at three very real situations: overcrowding, a tsunami, and an earthquake, and find out if those disasters could bring down the Golden Gate Bridge.
My name is Hassan Astani. I'm a professor of structural engineering and bridge engineering at UC Berkeley.
Turns out Astana is the perfect person to play along. He's been a bridge engineer for over 40 years.
God forbid, we don't want anything even related to collapse the Golden Gate Bridge. This is one of the best bridges in the world. But, you know, question is valid question. So we are in this business to provide you with the answer.
Let's start with the overcrowding. When the Golden Gate Bridge opened back in 1937, 50,000 people walked on to check it out. No problem. But in 1987, when the bridge turned 50, 300,000 pedestrians crowded on. Now, picture the bridge. The roadway gently curves up towards the middle. Well, on that day, the bridge actually flattened, losing its curved shape. Astana says the load stretched the cables.
The cable is the weakest link among deck, roadway, and the towers. So if anything is going to go first, it's going to be the main cables.
But he says it wasn't actually dangerous.
Because of 300,000 people being on the bridge, the stresses in the bridge reached 40% of capacity. Under ordinary load of bridge, which is cars and trucks, the stresses in the bridge are 25%.
So how many people would it take to collapse the bridge?
We did a calculation to see what happens.
And after crunching the numbers, Astana found it would take this many people to bring it down.
900,000 people. So you have to get the whole population of San Francisco and perhaps suburbs on the bridge to have the cable fail.
Just how would you fit 900,000 people onto the bridge?
For each square foot of area, that one square foot of area should hold 1.5 person, which is impossible.
Unless you stack them.
So if you put two people standing on top of each other, kind of like sitting on the shoulder, you might get 1.5 person per square foot.
And even with a double layer of people, Astana says you'd have to forcibly shove everyone onto the bridge to maximize space.
Japanese trains, they do it. In Japan, when the trains stop, there are people who push people inside the train. So you have to do the same.
So overcrowding is pretty unlikely. But what about a tsunami? Maybe the destruction these giant waves recently caused across the Pacific also gives us reason to be nervous. Could the Golden Gate Bridge survive a massive wall of water crashing into it? Astana says to figure out what kind of damage a tsunami would do to your structure, you have to know the wave's speed and the wave's height.
In order to have enough height of water that comes in with like 25 miles per hour speed and topples the towers of Golden Gate Bridge, you have to have the height equal to about 300 feet. And that's impossible. It's impossible to have any tsunami reaching the bridge that probably is more than even 50 feet.
That's because we don't have the type of underwater faults off our coastline that cause big tsunamis. Even if we did, the biggest earthquake-caused tsunami on record was 200 feet tall. But according to Astana, even that's not high enough to topple the Golden Gate Bridge.
If you want to have enough water that you can be toppled in the beach, it has to be up to your neck. That's the same thing with Golden Gate Bridge. But Golden Gate Bridge neck is pretty high.
So tsunamis, nothing to worry about. But what about an earthquake?
Well, that one, of course, is very serious, a real issue here. It's not like people on the bridge or tsunamis.
Astana says the towers of the bridge are so heavy, the original engineers didn't bolt them to their foundation.
So when the earthquake comes, the big one, the real one, the towers of Golden Gate Bridge can actually uplift.
That sounds scary. And Astana says bridge officials decided to make sure it doesn't happen after the Loma Prieta earthquake back in 1989. It famously happened during the World Series.
I don't know if we're on the air or not, and I'm not sure I care. That's the greatest open in the history of television, bar none.
That tumbler was magnitude 6.9. The Golden Gate Bridge suffered only minor damage. But bigger earthquakes can happen here.
The largest earthquake that San Andreas Fault can generate is 8.3.
Astana was tapped to be on the Golden Gate Bridge's seismic retrofit team and make the bridge safe in an 8.3.
The seismic retrofit that's done now, to the best of our knowledge, is going to prevent serious damage to the bridge.
The retrofit, which includes things like strengthening the bases so they don't get crushed, will be done in 2 to 4 years. Astana says the answers he came up with, while mostly hypothetical, proved what he already knew.
I'm very happy to tell your listeners that we are very proud as engineers that we have such structures that public use and enjoy. At the same time, they are so safe. And I appreciate you asking me to look into it. It was a really exciting weekend for me.
So fear not, Bay Area residents. The Golden Gate Bridge probably isn't coming down anytime soon. Except maybe in your local theater. For Cross Currents, I'm Isabel Angel.
That story first aired on KLW last summer. The updated projection for the Golden Gate Bridge retrofit completion is now the year 2020, provided federal dollars come through. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Okay, so if the big one strikes, we're good on the Golden Gate Bridge. But structural integrity is also a concern for skyscrapers, where architects are constantly pushing the boundaries of what's possible. For this next story, we'll head to Manhattan to learn how a faulty design almost brought one building down. It comes to us from KALW's 99% Invisible. Here's Roman Mars.
When it was built in 1977, Citicorp Center was, at 59 stories, the seventh tallest building in the world.
Citicorp Center is truly one of the most spectacular skyscrapers on a skyline known for its spectacular skyscrapers.
That's reporter Joel Werner.
This massive 59-story skyscraper levitates mid-air, hovering 115 feet above the street corner.
Of course, the building isn't really levitating. It's propped up on stilts, which join the building at the midpoint of each side. It does not look sturdy. But it's got to be sturdy. It's got to be safe, or they wouldn't have built it this way. Right? Most of the credit for this building is given to the chief structural engineer, William LeMessurier.
This is him giving a talk at MIT in 1995.
The whole problem was to build a building on a site that has a church in one corner.
St. Peter's sat at the corner of the lot, and when the church sold their land to Citicorp, it was on the condition that they build a new church in the exact same location. Beyond that, the company was free to build their skyscraper around the church and in the airspace above it. So a plan was hatched to float the building over the church.
A 59-story tower floating on 115-foot stilts.
For additional support, Lemessurier designed a chevron bracing structure. Essentially rows and rows of Vs, each 8 stories high, pointing down the middle of each building face.
And everything seemed just fine, until, as Lemessurier tells it, he got a phone call.
1978. I got a call from a student. I think he was an architectural student from New Jersey.
As the story goes, the student raised the alarm about Citicorp Center being particularly vulnerable at its corners.
Normally, buildings are strongest at their corners.
But this is no normal building.
This building is 915 feet high. If it failed, a whole slew of buildings from Midtown to Central Park would fall like dominoes. And when Lemessurier started to investigate the student's claims, he realized that the root of the problem had to do with how the chevron bracing structure was fastened together.
From here, Lemessurier and his team worked with the Citicorp bigwigs to coordinate emergency repairs on the building and weld it back together. They welded through the night and quit at daybreak, just as the building occupants returned to work.
And I know what you're thinking. Something like a newspaper might wonder why Citicorp Center was aglow with blowtorches all night, except...
all the newspapers in New York went on strike, so we had a press blackout, and that was the greatest thing that ever happened.
And construction was finished.
And this whole thing remained a secret for almost 20 years. After the story got out, it was written up as a textbook case of good ethics in structural engineering. New York was spared a tremendous loss of life, all because Bill Lemessurier was humble enough to give time to the inquiry of an undergraduate student. The way Lemessurier tells it, the college student, the young hero of our story, was lost to history.
Okay, wait for it.
Sometime in the early 90s, I remember being upstairs in my bedroom. My husband, who had been downstairs, started yelling, "Diane, your thesis building is on TV."
This is Diane Hartley.
As far as we can tell, she was the student in Lemessurier's story.
I fumbled for the remote.
This building could have killed tens of thousands of people.
I was aghast.
Diane never even considered that she might be the student in the story, male or not.
I never called Lemessurier.
Diane did talk to a junior engineer. She showed him her calculations.
But at the end of the day, I assumed I was wrong.
After all, she was just a college senior.
But somehow, Diane's discovery got silently passed up the totem pole within Lemessurier's firm. So it could be that's why Lemessurier remembers speaking to a male student. He was conflating Diane Hartley, the student, with his own staffer.
Perhaps my questions helped someone figure something out. I feel like I was a bit player in a play that had a happy ending.
That story was from KELW's 99% Invisible. For more, go to 99%invisible.org. To keep up with all our latest news, go to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents or subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast on iTunes. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Berenice Freedom, Catherine Girardeau, Chris Hambrick, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Allison Lee, Liz Mack, Holly J. McDeed, Marlo McKenzie, Casey Miner, Colin Peden, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producers were Judy Silber and Liz Mack. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll hear what's so special about monarch butterflies.
Trust me, no greater species makes people go cuckoo del fuego than the monarch. It hits people like they're blind.
Fluttering butterflies, tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News. This music is by Howl Divine. They'll be performing Saturday afternoon at Club Deluxe on Haight Street in San Francisco. Show starts at 5 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Where your boots are scuffed and ragged, you've been knocking them all night long. You're keeping late hours, and I know something's going on wrong with one of these days. Gonna beg me not to let you go. Where you make me feel like I'm going insane. You make me feel so good, and you cause me so much pain. One of these days, gonna beg me not to let you go. Where the blood in your veins, today it's running cold. Tomorrow you'll be calling me, warming up my soul.